The dances we do are really simply ethnic dances, which we put to a particular use. There's a great deal of loose talk nowadays about sacred dance, and it's nothing of the kind, except insofar as all dance can be sacred, all things can be sacred, if we look into them and use them in the right kind of way. So let us now get back to our introduction to Islamic mysticism. See where we've got to. So, the particular shape, form, and colour of Islamic mysticism. And I want to begin by quoting two apparently contradictory statements. That's a good point to begin, I think. And then to read something that I myself have written elsewhere on the subject, which may sound rather presumptuous, but which may pull the two together a little. The first quotation is from the book from which I've already quoted by William Walter Stace. And this is what he says. Islamic mysticism is more familiarly known as Sufism. The word Sufi, this is an irrelevance, but I'm reading it. The word Sufi, because there's so much debate about the meaning of the word Sufi and nobody knows. The word Sufi appears to have originated as a nickname which was connected with the wool clothing worn by some of the earlier mystics. Sufism flourished chiefly in Arab countries and in Persia. No precise date can be given for its origin, but it may be thought of as beginning to be important in the 9th century AD and as reaching its golden age in the 10th century. It continued at a high level for some centuries and entered on its decline from about the 15th century. This is Walter Stace's observation on Islamic mysticism, and he clearly identifies the two. End of quote. Now, one could add to this that Sufism was introduced to this country and the Western world in the early part of this century by Hazrat Inayat Khan and his son Pir Vilayat Khan. Hazrat, and the word Hazrat simply means blessed. I remember having to learn in Urdu the Beatitudes, and I had to say Hazrat, Hazrat, Hazrat so many times, blessed, etc., this, that, and the other. Hazrat Inayat Khan was a very amazing man, and we've got quite a lot of his writings here in the library, and for me they were very great signposts about 10 years ago. Now, Hazrat came to this country in the early part of this century, and of course his son Pir Vilayat is now the head of the Sufi order of the West. And so Sufism in that form as an order moved to the West largely through Hazrat, and now there are a number of Sufi orders in the West. There is only one which calls itself specifically non-Islamic, but that's neither here nor there. The second of my quotations is from the scholarly work by the well-known writer Idris Shah of Langton Green, no less. His book is called The Sufis. It's a massive work, and it's well worth reading if you really want to understand the whole background of Sufism. And the quotation from his book, The Sufis, that I'm going to give you is actually from the introduction by Robert Graves. And this is what Robert Graves writes about the Sufis. The Sufis are an ancient spiritual Freemasonry whose origins have never been traced or dated, so much for what Walter Stace says, nor do they themselves take much interest in such researches. That's very authentic, I like that. Being content to point out the occurrence of their own way of thought in different regions and periods. Though commonly mistaken for a Muslim, that is, Islamic sect, the Sufis are at home in all religions. If they call Islam to be the shell of Sufism, this is because they believe Sufism to be the secret teaching within all religions. According to Ali I'm not going to quote it, and you won't understand if I do, so now I'll leave it. Anyway, according to some early authority, a Sufi writer, the Prophet Muhammad himself said, "He who hears the voice of the Sufi people and does not say Amen is recorded in God's presence as one of the heedless. He who hears the voice of the Sufi people and does not say Amen is recorded in God's presence as one of the heedless. So there are the two statements which appear to be contradictory, one identifying Sufism with Islam and the other saying that you cannot do that. In answer to the question, what is a Sufi, I wrote in the little book, A Time for Knowledge, traditionally it is the name given to the mystics of Islam and describes those who are concerned with the essence of religion rather than its outward form. However, it cannot be restricted to Muslim mystics, for it accurately describes those who before and apart from the Islamic religion have followed the way of the heart. Sufis sometimes call themselves the people of the way. They are the mystics of every religion, and the true Sufi is able to assume a great variety of outward forms and able to move imperceptibly from one to the other. So the true Sufi is completely hidden. The true Sufi is completely hidden. Therefore, it is a contradiction in terms, in the name of Sufism, to introduce into one culture the cultural thought forms of another and the names of another. That is the antithesis of Sufism. There's a great deal of that in the West today. I remember in my own early days on the spiritual path, having a teacher at that time who was a very important signpost to me. And I said, my teacher is a Sufi. And I said, are you a Sufi? And the answer was, the question has no meaning and any answer I could give you wouldn't have one either. So I thought that was a true Sufi answer, really. I eventually elicited a better answer than that, what to me was a better one, and I got the reply, I aspire to Sufi understanding. I aspire to Sufi understanding. Now let me return to the quotation from Robert Graves that Islam may be called the shell of Sufism. That is undoubtedly accurate, the shell of Sufism. For without doubt, historically, and until quite recent times in the West, Sufism has been the embodiment of the familiar dress of Islamic mysticism. What of the place of the Holy Quran in Islamic mysticism? To many non-Muslims, especially Christians, approaching the Quran for the first time, this holy book of the Muslim religion may appear to them as primarily a code of ethics and of rules and regulations governing every aspect of day-to-day living. Critics of the Quran have dismissed it as little more than a conglomeration of Jewish legalism, anti-Christian polemics, interspersed with fierce assertions of the supremacy of Allah, and extolling Allah, the merciful, the compassionate, in the context of a book that appears to be harsh in its the punishments it would mete out to those who offend against the law or ethics. For the Sufi, the Quran is a document with numerous levels of transmission and understanding. Numerous levels of transmission of understanding. And of course, this is equally true of the New Testament, each of which has a meaning in accordance with the capacity for understanding of the reason, of the reader. So when you begin to approach with this understanding, you see how necessary the superficial interpretation or understanding of the Quran was at that time when it came into being in the Arab world, how very necessary it was. It related immediately to the culture of the country and what was necessary. But the very fact that from the context of Islam, there has been produced this wonderful stream of mysticism. You can't compare and say, well, there are far more greater Islamic mystics than there are Christian mystics. But it's an interesting fact that whereas Christian mysticism has been a rather elitist thing, on the whole, a fairly middle class or upper middle class thing, with those who have time to learn all the language, and they belong to very elitist groups. And you have to learn the whole thing, of course, first. This is not so of Islamic mysticism, not so at all. It belonged to the very ordinary, simple Arab. Given this approach to the Quran, its hidden teaching is both a source of inspiration for the Muslim mystic and a way into understanding the essential unity of the Christian and the Muslim scriptures. The Muslim mystic finds no difficulty at all in accepting the Quran as it stands, as the revealed word of God, indeed the final word of God to humanity. For beyond its literal translation, he perceives, without the need to alter one word, that mystical level at which all the people of the way are united. He may, of course, as a Muslim, regard the literal interpretation of the Quran as a necessary corrective to the literal interpretation of the New Testament. So when you're on that level, you may argue as a Muslim and argue as a Christian, as a Muslim theologian and a Christian theologian, you can go to hammer and tongues and get nowhere eventually. But at that level, you may even as a Muslim mystic and as a Christian mystic choose to argue at that level, and you find that there is apparent great clashes. But as a mystic, the Muslim would recognize the essential unity of both documents. It is because of this concept of levels of understanding, which is so central to Islamic mysticism, that one is more likely to find a stronger appreciation of the universality of true mysticism amongst Muslims than amongst Christians. A great deal of Sufi literature is concerned, often at the level of humour, to teach this truth. Take, for example, the many Nasr al-Din stories. We read the Nasr al-Din stories here regularly. Many are very funny indeed, and Idris Shah has reproduced a great many in his various books. Let me read one to illustrate the point. This first story illustrates that truth has many facets. Truth has many facets. Nasr al-Din, in conversation with a certain king, insisted that apparent truth resembles inner truth only slightly, and that in order to understand inner truth, it is necessary to practice certain things. Laws, he maintained, as such, do not make people better. But the king disagreed and was quite sure that he could and would force people to observe the truth. Now his city was entered by a bridge. On the bridge, he built a gallows. The following day at dawn, when the gates were opened, the captain of the guard was stationed with a squad of troops to examine all who entered. An announcement was made. All about to enter the city will be questioned. If they tell the truth, they will be allowed to enter. If they lie, they will be hanged. Nasr al-Din stepped forward and was challenged. Where are you going? On my way, he replied, to be hanged. We don't believe you, the soldiers replied. Very well, he said, then hang me. But if we hang you for lying, we will have made what you said come true. That's right. Now you know what truth is, your truth. Well, that's a fairly typical Nasr al-Din Sufi story. Islamic mysticism is concerned, first of all, with the how of teaching and the how of learning. Gnosis, or inner understanding, is necessary. And this comes only with inner awakening. Such awakening may be brought about by shock. That is the destruction, sometimes in a violent way, of conditioned responses. Such shock comes through experiencing truth as more than an intellectual assent. So a Sufi master would put a disciple into a situation where he would experience something, and this experience would shock into a different level of consciousness. So, such learning of this kind comes primarily through a teacher or a sheikh. The sheikhs are the great spiritual leaders in Sufism, the great spiritual masters of Islam. They operate within orders, of which there are very many, as I said earlier, each emphasizing different facets and aspects of the means of teaching inner truth. In the same way that in the Christian church, of course, you've got many different orders for men and women, though there is a fundamental difference, because there is no such thing as monasticism in Islam, the taking of vows of poverty, chastity and obedience, and living in community under those vows. It is quite foreign to Islam's understanding. But the orders as such exist and demonstrate different aspects of truth in the same way that the great orders of the Christian church do. The Mevlevi order, which was founded by Rumi, of whom we shall be hearing a little more later on, in the 13th century, has as its most characteristic feature the famous whirling dance. This is performed by the faqir, that is, the poor in spirit. Interesting. Blessed are the poor in spirit, the faqir, for they shall see God. Or in the Persian form, the dervishes. It's unfortunate that in the West we've got a curious image of whirling dervishes. We probably relate them to Khartoum and what happened to General Gordon, and we think of people whirling around with knives and about to sort of go into a frenzy and demolish people. Well, of course, that's all wrong. A dervish, in its true sense, is a mystic, one who is poor in spirit. The turning is performed, and it's not a performance as such, but I use the word here in a different sense. The turning is performed in the context of the zikr, that is, the invocation or quintessential prayer, the prayer of the heart, the calling on the name of Allah. This dance is still performed at Konya in Turkey, where Rumi's tomb is to be found, and of course it's performed in many parts of the world within the order. This is an art form, but it's primarily a means of grace, an outward and visible sign of an inward and spiritual reality. Surely that very thing described by T.S. Eliot in the Four Quartets, at the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point there the dance is, but neither arrest nor movement, and do not call it fixity, where past and future are gathered, neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline, except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance, and there is only the dance. And from the words of the Omega Vision, thus man in time now joins the timeless dance, which out of time takes up the cosmic rhythm. It's much more. It is moving from the ego into a whole cosmic dimension. So it's no longer a particular individual doing it beautifully. That all goes. There's the merging into oneness. I'd like here to digress for a moment to look at an area which to me is very fascinating indeed. I've always wanted to know about the link between St. Francis and the Sufis, because St. Francis undoubtedly was one of the greatest Sufis who ever lived, certainly with a little s, and possibly with a big s, very probably with a big s. Pope John XXIII, whose picture should have arrived today, was undoubtedly a Sufi. very great Sufi. His love encompassed all the people of the way, all the people of the way. And if the true Sufi is hidden, and if the truest of Sufis have to be hidden for a particular purpose, why should not Sufis be consciously occupying the chair of St. Peter? Why not? Why not? No one would ever know, except those who needed to know. So, St. Francis of Assisi. What are the indications of contact between the Sufis and St. Francis? Rumi was still alive during the lifetime of St. Francis, who was born in 1182. There is little doubt that the development of Christian monasticism during the Middle Ages was influenced by the penetration of Islamic mysticism to the West. Of course, and Molly will deal with this, I'm sure, explicitly this afternoon, Spain being under Muslim occupation, Christianity was greatly influenced by Islam and by Sufism. Against this background, a number of stories about St. Francis assume a new significance. Christian legends, not Islamic legends, but Christian legends about St. Francis, seen against the background of Sufism and his highly probable contact with Sufism, do seem to make sense. I'll just refer to one or two. As I say, without doubt, he was in spirit, and possibly by initiation, one of the great Sufis. And in his person, it is possible to find a mystical bridge between Christianity and Islam. I've already referred to the whirling dervishes. As a result of their spinning under the direction of a master, one of the things that may and frequently does happen is intuitive knowledge, the attainment of intuitive knowledge through being centered. Now, Rumi's school of dervishes was certainly in full operation in Asia Minor during Francis's lifetime. And one must ask the question, does this throw any light on what otherwise is a very puzzling legend, the spinning story? There's a commonly known legend of St. Francis called the spinning story. And the story is as follows. Francis was walking in Tuscany with one of his disciples, Brother Masio, and they arrived at a fork in the road, where one path led to Florence, another to Arezzo, and the third to Siena. The disciple inquired of Francis which way they should take, to which the master replied, "The road which God wills." "And which is that?" asked Manasseh. "We will know by a sign. I command you now by your vow of obedience to turn round and round as children do, until I tell you to stop." In obedience, the poor disciple turned round and round until he fell down from giddiness. Francis ordered him up again. He staggered to his feet and looked beseechingly at his master, but remembering his vow, began to twirl his best, and he continued spinning until finally he fell down as though all his life he'd been spinning. When he heard the welcome words, "Stop," and Francis said, "Tell me whither your face is turned." "To Siena," gasped the disciple. "Then to Siena we must go," said Francis. Well, I mean, one doesn't want to make too much of it, but against the background of the dervishes, it could well be that there is a link. Another fascinating story is that of Francis visiting Pope Innocent. Most popes named Innocent were anything but that's another story. Could be said of perhaps some pious popes not being... Well, I mustn't say that, must I? He went to see Pope Innocent in order to have his new order accepted. According to Bonaventura, Francis went armed with a parable concerning a rich and mighty king. And this rich and mighty king took to himself as wife a very beautiful woman who lived in the desert, in whom he greatly delighted, and by whom he had children who bore his true image. When her sons were grown, the woman said, "Be not ashamed, my sons, for you too are children of a king." Now the Sufis, there's a lot more to this story, but I don't want to go into any more details at the moment, relating it to the Old Testament and Ishmael and so on. The Sufis repeat this story as an indication that Francis, through a parable, had tried to explain to the Pope that the Sufis were the esoteric Christians out of the desert, representing Christianity in a continuing form, and wanted to gain acceptance for them. In or about 1224, the most important of all Francis's songs was composed, the Song of the Sun, after his journey to the East. And Rumi himself wrote numerous poems dedicated to the sun. In his poetry, the word sun occurs again and again. When Francis was 35, he tried to reach the East, and these journeys to the East have always been explained by Christian orthodoxy as fervent attempts to convert the Muslims. There's been no evidence of this at all, but it's assumed that Francis, as a very great Christian, when he penetrated the East, was going to try and convert the Muslims. He was going specifically to Syria. He went into Syria, to the part of Syria, very close to that area of Asia Minor, where the whirling dervishes were very common. He's prevented by financial reasons from going too far. And then he had another attempt. And with a companion, he traversed the whole kingdom of Aragon in Spain, though nobody knows why he did this. Spain was very much penetrated with Sufi ideas and schools. He did not reach Morocco, and in 1214 he returned home. Well, undoubtedly, he was in touch with the spirituality of his day. Another story tells how he visited the Sultan Malik el-Kamal on the Nile after setting out for the Crusades, and he was very well received. The official Christian interpretation of this visit is, of course, that Francis went to convert the Sultan to Christianity. He was very well received by the Sultan, as I say. The Sufis themselves see something quite different in this contact between Francis and the Sultan. Francis is seen as a troubadour, looking and searching for his true roots, his spiritual home. It is interesting that on recrossing the Nile and returning to the Christians, he tried desperately to dissuade them from attacking the enemies. He wasn't successful. According to Idris Shah, the atmosphere and setting of the Franciscan order is closer to a dervish organization than anything else. He goes on to say that because of the failure to consciously incorporate knowledge and understanding within the Franciscan order, it never developed in the way that it could have done. Well, that's an opinion and a comment, but it's worth hearing. Don't tell the Franciscans I said that. Either the Anglican Franciscans or the Roman Catholic ones. Francis's action in throwing away the spiked crosses worn by his monks is seen by Idris Shah as resembling the dervish practice of rejecting a cross. Now, it's very easy to misinterpret this. It is said that the dervishes trample on the Christian cross, and that's blasphemy. Well, the dervishes who do this in a ritual way, a very conscious way, with the words, "You may have the cross, we have the meaning of the cross." And this practice, of course, is still in use. An interesting Sufi comment on Francis' attitude to salvation is as follows. Like the Sufis, and unlike the ordinary Christians of the day, his followers were not to think of their own salvation first. This principle is stressed again and again amongst the Sufis, who consider regard for personal salvation to be an expression of vanity. A regard for personal salvation as an expression of vanity. So much for Francis. It may or may not be so, and it's probably impossible to go any further than that. Perhaps someday somebody will write a book with a great deal more knowledge and information. Now, let us return to this question of awakening, the great stress that Sufis place on that of awakening. And also the Sufis will say, and Hazrat Khan makes a great deal of this, there is a time to awaken and there is a time to leave asleep. There is a time to awaken and a time to leave asleep. Some of you may know that lovely story of Alice Bailey, because Alice Bailey went through many stages in her spiritual life. She was connected with Tunbridge Wells, incidentally. Very important. And Alice Bailey in her early days was very much a fundamentalist Christian missionary in India trying to convert the British troops to accept Christ, going around almost banging people on the head with the Bible. And one day she was vehemently trying to persuade a British soldier to accept Christ, and finally gave up in exasperation and said to her companion, "Oh, why can't he accept?" And the companion said, "Now look, stand back. Just look at the man, look at the shape of his face, be aware of what he is, be aware of his whole being, respect that being, and then commit him to God. Then commit him to God." There must be tremendous respect for every individual and every individual's path. And it isn't always right to awaken or try to awaken. There is a time for sleeping, and a time, there is a critical time for awaking. But that is important, very important to the Sufi. And it is important to remember that whereas Christian mystics, as I said earlier, was until very much recently very much the preserve of the elite, Islamic mysticism has always been something of the people. Awakening can come in a thousand different and very ordinary ways. So the ordinary becomes the extraordinary. Let me illustrate this with another Nasruddin story. If you tell a person something simply in so many words, it will, as like as not, slide off him and not be absorbed. A practical demonstration is necessary. A beggar once called up to Nasruddin, who was working on his roof. When Nasruddin had with some difficulty reached the ground, the beggar begged him for alms. Said Nasruddin, "Why didn't you come up to see me on the roof?" "Oh," replied the man, "I was too ashamed." "But," said Nasruddin, "you shouldn't have false pride. Climb with me up onto the roof." So, with some difficulty, they both climbed onto the roof. When they reached the top, Nasruddin started work again. And turning to the man, said, "No, I have nothing for you." I bet he remembered that. As Islamic mystics see it, within mankind is a treasure, and this treasure can be found only by looking for it. The treasure is, as it were, held inside a house, that is, with inside fixed thought patterns. These have to be broken down before it can be found, and before we can perceive and touch reality. Another story, this time by Rumi, which illustrates this. I'm sure some of you know this story. An elephant belonging to a travelling exhibition had been stabled near a town where no elephant had ever been seen before. Four curious citizens, hearing of the hidden wonder, went to see if they could get a preview of it. When they arrived at the stable, they found that there was no light. The investigation, therefore, had to be carried out in the dark. One, touching the trunk, thought that the creature must resemble a hose pipe. The second felt an ear and concluded that it was a fan. The third, feeling a leg, could liken it only to a living pillar. When the fourth put his hand on its back, he was quite convinced that it was some kind of throne. None could form the complete picture, and of the part that each felt, he could only refer to it in terms of things which he already knew. The result of this expedition was confusion. Each one was sure that he was right, and none of the other town people could understand what had happened to or what the investigators had really experienced. Now, Rumi teaches that if there had been a light in the house, multiplicity would be seen, in fact, to be unity. When there is light in the house, multiplicity is seen to be unity. Man sees only pieces of things because his mind is fixed in a pattern designed to see things piecemeal. It is the teacher's function to establish this to the pupil, and Rumi has made this the subject of a poem. And I think after this we'll close this session. Destroy your house, and with the treasure hidden in it, you will be able to build thousands of houses. The treasure lies under it. There is no help for it. Hesitate not to pull it down Do not tarry. And just one final comment. Because of that intense awareness of the indwelling of God in all things, mystics of all religions are frequently accused of the heresy of pantheism. Heresy used to be a dreadful word, and before Pope John the 23rd, of blessed memory, Roman Catholics had to call Protestant heretics. The word is not used any longer. It may be thought of, but it's not used. Pantheism, of course, is the heresy of regarding God and the universe as one. Because of Orthodox Islam's rigid monotheism and its utter abhorrence of identifying the Creator with creation, this has been even more pronounced in Islam than in Christianity. Abu Yazid al-Bistami, who died in 875, having declared that God was in his soul, horrified the Orthodox by exclaiming, "Glory to me, how great is my majesty." Another mystic, the one I referred to earlier, Hilaj, was crucified in 922 for using language which to the Orthodox implied that he was claiming to be a divine incarnation. So deeply conscious was he of the I am identity that he proclaimed, "I am the truth." What a powerful echo of the words of Jesus himself. Like traditional Christian mysticism, Islamic mysticism indicates degrees and stages in the contemplative life. This is where we'll stop, by just contemplating the degrees and stages. These are sometimes likened to seven valleys, and these are illustrated in the famous poem by the Sufi Attar, who lived in the 13th century, The Conference of the Birds. It's a wonderful story. Won't there be time to read it today? I don't know, but it contains, like Mr. God, This Is Anna, it contains all truth in a very different kind of way. I think this is a good time to stop, so we'll have a time of silence together.